Anybody home?
What kind of party is this, anyway?
A very strange party, if you'll pardon the expression.
Radio General Erko.
Yes, sir, but that's not what's so peculiar.
Put it on the bridge speakers, Lieutenant.
Pay more attention.
DJ 7 L.
I thought it might be static, but not on every channel. Tend to sound like...
Holy Mountain Printing Podcast.
Hill.
Hear me and hear me.
Wait a minute, what's that?
I demand an explanation.
Look at that one, bigger than the rest. He looks like...
Invasion by creatures from space confirmed. New York City may be their next objective.
Yes, stop.
And get out of here.
Getting some very strange
reports
from
sea
bay level.
In
what way strange?
Holy Mountain Printing Podcast.
Listen to this.
Welcome to the Holy Mountain Printing Podcast.
All right, let's talk about this. Let's talk about this playlist then in part two of this podcast, because the first part went on longer than we thought it was going to go on. So,
no surprise.
How do you want to talk about this? Like, I don't know. Do you just want to be okay? So we talked about hip hop a bit there at the end of the first part of this conversation. There's a bunch of hip hop on this. Do you want to start talking about that? Let's talk about that. There's so much hip hop on this playlist.
Yeah, there's a lot. Go for it. Let's go for it.
So we've got a bunch of Griselda stuff on here. We've got Conway. We've got West Side Gun. I did have a West Side Gun track, but I took it off because you already had one. So I thought, well, I'll put someone else on. I'll put a Sean Price track on instead. Rest in peace, Sean Price. So tell me about Griselda, because they're making a lot of noise right now. A lot of kids are into them. Definitely a lot of punk and hardcore kids who may not have been listening to hip-hop before are starting to rep them. You and I both wear their shit. Fans, tell me, when did you first hear Griselda? What are your thoughts on them?
So I actually didn't know anything about Griselda until you started talking to me about them a couple years ago. And it was ironic because another like really close friend of mine who I also, you know, I really regard his opinions highly. He was also telling me about Conway and West Side Gun at, like, right around the same period of time. So I had both of you guys, you know, telling me to listen, and I'm kind of lazy. Maybe at first glance, I wasn't listening. And when I actually took the time, I don't know, it just really struck me. It's just like, I really like dark hip hop, like really dark themes, you know? And I like it to be simplistic and kind of gritty. And they kind of have that boom bap, like really simple. I don't know. It just really struck me. And they're super prolific. And I don't know. It was like easy movement to get behind because these guys, they feel like really DIY hustling guys. And you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. I'm a huge fan. And I know not everyone is, and that's okay. Like, you don't have to be a huge fan of everything, but I think even if you're not a huge fan, but you're into hip hop, I think what you have to recognize is that they've made it cool to do gritty street hip hop again with samples, and like they've made it acceptable to do that again, which is a win for all of us. So even if you don't like West Side Gun and Conway and Benny, who are the people that make up Griselda or Derringer's production, like, that's fine, but
you at least recognize the movement.
But you have to recognize that, you know, they didn't reinvent the wheel with this stuff, but they definitely made it, like, you know, fuck, I love Rock Marciano, like love him so much.
Yeah, me too.
But I feel like more people are listening to Rock Marcy than would have been previously, because Griselda is doing that style that Rock Marcy was doing a lot of, and people kind of look back and go, okay, this is, it's now cool to be, it's okay to like this kind of stuff now. So yeah, I think it's really exciting. And the same with everything, like, you know, whenever something starts to get noticed, there's always like 100 shitty imitators doing stuff. It's the same with literally every single kind of music in the world. You know, think about any discussion on black metal that happens right now. Like, think of any discussion on fucking power violence, which, you know, we're not going to have that discussion on power violence. Because I refuse to have any discussions on power violence in 2020, at least. But I don't know. I think there's good stuff. And I had a Griselda track on here, like a West Side Gun song, and I had Black Tar, which was a track he did maybe 4 or 5 years ago with Sean Price, which is probably my favorite West Side Gun track. I took it off, but if you've never heard this stuff and you're listening to this and you like it, and I definitely recommend the song West Side Gun. Also, I'm conscious that most people would be coming across this primarily through the Full of Hell thing, but also some people through myself. And for me, I tried to kind of pick hip hop that was kind of darker but still actually, you know, representing hip hop. You know, I put Dante on here, who's a local, put his song on here, Heavy Hammer, because I feel like if you can get into like doom and grindcore and stuff, and you probably gonna, and if you might like hip hop, you're gonna like that. Like, it's, I don't know. That's that's what,
yeah, it gets me fired up. I think I drove my band crazy because I was so excited about this crew of people and all of these releases, you know. It was just like so much, and it was so dark and so, I don't know, it just got me like juiced up that I was just talking about it all the time, and they refused to check it out. And like two days ago, I got a text from Sam, and he's like, dude, Pray for Paris is awesome. And I'm just like, I told you, I know I'm like the dorkiest dude, you know, and I'm like this like soft as kitten, like motherfucker, but like this shit is fucking awesome. I mean, I think I heard Hitler too first, and it has a Big L sample at the beginning. And mm-hmm. I honestly, my taste in hip hop is like pretty normie. You know, I love the big greats, and Big L was like one of my all time favorites. Like, just so lyrically advanced to me.
I'm sorry, but liking Big L isn't like basic taste. Like, Big L is fucking amazing. It's like,
well, I know it's amazing, but I feel like that's everybody's. You know, everybody loves Tribe Called Quest. Everybody loves Big L. Everybody loves Big Pun. You know what I mean? Like, there's a reason.
It's because that shit's good.
Yeah,
it's like there's a, you know, if you like black metal but you don't like Bathory, it's like, fuck off. Like, yeah, you know, it's the same thing. It's like these standards, you know, like, yeah.
But it struck me though, because when I heard West Side Gun's voice is like so important to me. Mm-hmm. And honestly, Benny is my least favorite of the three, not because of anything to do with his production or his lyrics. I think he's like, feels like once in a generation kind of lyricist, but his voice just kind of bores me, because it's just kind of, you know, even tempoed, like just kind of the tone is just kind of boring to me. But West Side Gun's got that baby voice, and it's just like, dude, I don't know. It kind of gave me some Big L vibes anyway, because I felt mm-hmm. like Big L kind of had like a squeaky voice.
Yeah.
And dude, I was just like, I still get so fired up thinking about it. And like, I put a song on here from the little MF Doom EP that he did.
Yeah.
That shit is so fucking crazy and grimy and good. I mean, I don't know. It's like literally perfect hip hop for me. Not that I'm an expert, but like, to me, it speaks to me.
Yeah, my favorite of the Griselda people is Benny. So
yeah, and same with my buddy. Like, and a lot of people I know, and that's totally fair. The Tana Talk stuff is like, I mean, all of his shit's awesome. I listen to the new records every time they come out. Yeah. But the guys that stick with me, I was like a huge West Side Gun head for a while. It actually took me a little longer to get into Conway, but Conway's story and voice also very unique and crazy. And dude, some of his dark tracks, like, man, I don't know which ones I even put on here, but so this song Lando Lakes that I put on here has that Busta Rhymes spot on it. And Busta Rhymes, like, obviously loves these guys. He's got a couple spots. And the Busta Rhymes that I was familiar with, at least, was just like the really rapid fire, like, but this, he's like slowed down. Dude, it sounds murderous. It's sick as fuck. His spots are so good. And they're not like featuring Busta Rhymes. Half the time, he's not even credited on his spots. He's just kind of like, I don't know. There's just a whole vibe with this crew. I think it's more in line with something that like we're accustomed to, like culturally, like, you know what I mean? Like, as far as like how they do business and like how they put out their music, they're really prolific, you know? Yeah. It's just really fucking cool. I think it's easy to be inspired by it. And like, I don't know, what's not to love when like the crew that you're really, really into putting out new music like every couple months and it's not just bullshit.
Yeah, for sure. So I took off the West Side Gun Sean Price track because you had him on. So, but I replaced it with a Sean Price song with MF Doom. One of the ones that was put together, completed after Sean Price died a few years ago. So I guess we got MF Doom twice featured on this. Doing features on this place, but I put Sean Price in that same kind of category as I put the Griselda crew, and Sean Price. I think I don't know. Like I think Sean Price is probably my favorite rapper. It's a question that I think about fairly often, and I have a hard time answering it. But I think if you pushed me, I'd say that Sean Price was probably my full time favorite rapper for me.
That's awesome. So. I'm going to ask you about three songs that I put on here, actually, because of your history with the band. I put Hatred Surge's songs from the Brutal Supremacy four-way split because to me, as I've told you before, that four-way split and particularly the bands on it, especially Hatred Surge and Mind Eraser, are like pivotal bands for me, actually. Yeah. Like, really, to me, felt like the best of the best.
That compilation is a double 7-inch with one side each from Mind Eraser, Hatred Surge, Iron Lung, and Scapegoat.
Yeah.
When did that come out? 2011?
Yeah, sounds about right.
I think that was 2011 that came out.
But this was when Hatred Surge had Rahi doing some vocals.
So the final period of Hatred Surge.
Yeah, like right before they put out those other couple records. And I don't know, just the way Alex wrote these songs, or maybe it was... what's his name, the drummer from Power Trip and Mammoth Grinder, maybe Ulsh wrote the songs. I'm not sure if Alex wrote everything or what.
I think Alex did, but it's not for me.
The way these, particularly these three songs, there's like something to be said, I think, for punk bands in a short format. Like, I think the 7-inch is like the perfect format in a lot of ways. Like, you really got to nail it because you only have like, you know what, like 5 minutes per side or something. So I just feel like this is a really perfect Hatred Surge quote unquote album because these three songs are just like, I don't know. They're just like so well written. They're just crushing. And Alex had this weird thing with his vocals where I really feel like he was like God tier at the like embellishments, like the,
yeah.
He had so many great moments, you know?
Yeah.
You guys toured with them quite a bit.
A lot, yeah. We played a lot of, and we talked about in the last podcast, the last episode. We split this in two. In the last part, we talked about how I played in Fall of Hell for a show once. The live lineup for Hatred Surge for two shows a very long time ago was the Endless Blockade with Alex singing. So I played bass twice as Hatred Surge, which again I forgot about that until recently. Yeah, played a lot of shows with Hatred Surge and Iron Lung. Played with all the bands that are on that comp. Alex is one of my best friends, still talk a lot. Alex is someone who just really, really understands music. Like he's an actual musician. I'm merely someone who owns a bass. Alex is an actual musician. He really understands music and how it's put together. A lot of time for Alex, would do anything for that guy. I'm not going to talk for Alex, but we were talking about in the previous one about how, you know, being angry and pissed off and going through extreme life events, it doesn't make us particularly creative. And I was sharing how for myself, like it's the post-event analysis has assisted me with my creativity, but also understanding the event. And I referenced the post-traumatic stress disorder I have from a previous job through being witness to a vast amount of death, like a huge amount of death, and did a number on me. And I'm not going to talk for Alex, but I believe that this period of Hatred Surge kind of comes after a quite an intense period of turmoil that was in his life. And a lot of it speaks to that, which I think might be also where you're hearing kind of the perfection in this one and just how like just fucking hard this material is with Hatred.
Yeah, it's very dark and very hard.
It definitely comes from like I say, I'm not going to speak for Alex, but I don't think it's a huge breaching of an oath of secrecy to say that this was came out of a very, very difficult period from Alex's life, and this is the music that came out of that, and that's also why the music on the Mammoth Grinder split sounds so different, because it was like a
different life period.
It's like a response to that period of his life. I fucking love Hatred Surge. Love Alex.
Yeah. Didn't you guys tour Europe? Endless Blockade.
We did. Yeah, Surge. Yeah, and Iron Lung. Yeah, we.
Tour.
It sucked. No one came to any of the shows. Yeah, give a shit.
You know, that's like insane to us. And like when we first started touring Europe, I mean, we were also like, we had nothing out, no music really. There was no reason for people to come see us. But I really have felt until recent years that like, see, I don't want to say Europe. It seems like the mainland Europe doesn't like really want to go see shows that my kind of band, like shows for our kind of music. But I mean, clearly they love like actual grindcore. But I mean, like whatever weirdo fake shit Full of Hell does, and where I felt like we were kind of aligned with, you know, in ethos to the Endless Blockade and Iron Lung and Hatred Surge. You know what I mean? Those are three bands that to us are legends, like as far as our personal taste goes. And I felt like Europe, when I heard about that, I was like, that makes sense, because I feel like Europe doesn't fucking care about that kind of music.
But it does. It does sometimes. Our tour wasn't very good, and that's fine. That's because we were playing the music people didn't want to hear. That's okay. That's my fault. That's our fault. You
know? Of course.
Getting mad that people didn't come out and see a band because they don't want us. Like they didn't want to see it because they didn't fucking care about it. That's fine.
Yeah, of course.
We did that tour. We did a lot of tours together. I think we did two or three tours with Hatred Surge, or if not full tour, like we ran into Hatred Surge all the time. Like the first West Coast, we did two West Coast tours. The first tour we did on the West Coast, in fact, both had Hatred Surge on them. We played shows. That's when I met Alex in 2005, maybe. We played a bunch of shows with. We used to play all the time with Insect Warfare and Hatred Surge. You know, for bands that were from Texas and Canada, we managed to constantly play with these bands, which was fucking cool. Those bands were all great, and they all went on to do amazing things. Those were a long time ago.
Was there any comical or spiritually crushing moments on that European tour? I'm sorry, I'm like morbidly curious, because to me that lineup's just so goddamn good that I don't even know if it would necessarily be appreciated to the level it should be today, let alone like whatever year it actually happened. Telling me about feces. Burning feces outside an unnamed squat. I don't even want to name the city.
We didn't even play that show. That's the thing. We didn't even play that show. We had a night off and we went to see we were in Berlin and we didn't have a show on.
Mystery gone.
I didn't name the venue. We went to see a Tavit Cadet who were playing a show at this venue. There was people burning shit in a bonfire.
It's so sick.
Go on tour, you get crazy events. It was weird. It was like a vacation with, you know, some of my best friends, like the two dudes in Iron Lung, like all of us in Blockade, Alex from Hatred Surge, like fucking loved all those dudes. Like it was just fun. It was like a vacation where we had to fucking make a bunch of noise for 20 minutes every night. I think my overwhelming memory is playing a show in somewhere in Denmark, not Copenhagen, and there was no one there, and we still managed to get paid like 300 euros, and we're like, okay, but eight people came, why are you paying so much money? And
Denmark.
Yeah, but we were just hanging out afterwards, and we were getting drunk, and Alex, they were using Alex's iPod, and I put on Discharge, and Alex just fucking ripped off his shirt like the Incredible Hulk, and just fucking moshed across the bar. There's no one in there, and like accidentally smashed a bunch of glasses, and the staff at the venue were just like so like fucking pissed. They're like, dude, what's going on? Alex is in me like, oh, puts his shirt back on and sweeps up, and that to me just like kind of summed up the tour, just like just hanging out at a bar, then than Alex just fucking moshing a discharge and breaking a bunch of glass.
Deconstruction of the bar.
Yeah, exactly. And the people being pissed where we were at and us just cleaning it up and saying sorry and then carrying on drinking. It was a fucking tour.
I think like meeting you guys and becoming friends with you guys really puts into perspective just like how it's not so weird for anyone to consider any album like their most legendary favorite album, because to me Deconstruct is like such a fucking go-to record for you know the genre that it sits in, and I think like as more time passes, people that know what's up are gonna continue to always reference that record as like a very important example of like the genre at this time and place. And I'm sure for Alex, who's like a very humble person, he's like, whatever, like what is this, it's stupid. And I know the Mind Eraser guys, they seem to be like very humble too in that way, it's like Glacial Rain and Conscious Unconscious and all those records to me are incredibly important hardcore records in terms of my progression as like a person. But to those guys, it's their shit. That's weird that some kid thinks that. And I think it's weird if I ever hear from a kid who's like, Full of Hell means this much to me, but who am I to say, really? And it just goes to show like, how people consume this art or whatever. And like, I don't know, it's all perspective. And if someone thinks that, about your work, that's like a pretty special thing. And like, you're in that position with like a bunch of people, and it's weird, right? But it kind of is what it is, and that's a positive.
Yeah.
But it's weird. I mean, sure, I'm sure, because it's like it's just the music that you and your friends were making, but it means so much to certain people.
Which is nice. I don't know what to say about that though. Like, it's just the music that we made because we were very obsessed.
Yeah,
we were just obsessed with what we were doing and how to put our own spin on it, and we really just got together and like it's a fucking story of any band. We really just worked really hard at it, and like, well, what do we like about this, what do we not like about this, how do we do this, how do we like what rules are we going to put in on our compositions, and when we can only do this three times a record and we can never do this. And
like, I guess my point is like once the record's out there, it's like it's not even yours anymore. It's like you feel weird with people looking at what you've made in like such a maybe a glowing light or such a light at all, but like once it's out there, it's like it's no longer, it's got its own own trajectory and its own it just exists out there forever, and someone might pick it up and like find all of this experience in it. It's just really interesting to see like an album and where it goes afterwards, and again, like I'm thinking about it a lot lately because we're putting out those old Full Hell records, but like I care about those in terms of like life experience, but I don't like appreciate them in a way like anybody else might, like other people might. Like, I don't want to think about those records really. Like it's been done. We did it. We were learning, blah, blah, blah. But like, people might value it, and like there's nothing negative to say about that really. It's, I don't know. Maybe I'm rambling.
I want to tie that into something. So I have a song by Ringworm on this album, on this playlist, from the song Sideshow from the first album, The Promise. And it's funny because the two of us were talking about this a couple of days ago, and it was clear to me that you were surprised they put Ringworm on it. But your association of Ringworm is very different from my association with Ringworm. So for me, Ringworm was this band, early 90s Cleveland band, who was just like really intensely violent sounding and were doing a very interesting kind of like slightly Slayer hardcore before all those Belgian dudes started doing that Slayer hardcore, but like just like still actually hardcore and like good and tough sounding, and really meant a lot to me. And that Ringworm album, the first one, and the demo are still hugely influential on me. And that, but Ringworm to me, because I'm 46 years old, are frozen in time to me as this entity from the early 90s. And I like some of the, I really like the second album, Birth is Pain, a lot. And I like parts of Justice Replaced by Revenge. And then after that, I honestly couldn't tell you what Ringworm sound like now because I haven't heard them. I have heard some more recent stuff, but when I say more recent, it was still probably 13 years ago. And to you, I think Ringworm is not this band frozen in time that I associate them with. It's something different. And and I don't know what you associate Ringworm with, and I'm not, I don't want to say we were talking shit on them, because we definitely weren't.
No, but not
I could tell that you were like, it's weird that you put Ringworm on the sound like it, but it's not weird because that first album just fucking kicked my ass when it came out, and oh my god, and I put it on the other day when I was doing a workout, and it's just like, fuck me, I just want to flip a cop car over right now listening to this, and it still does that to me almost 30 years later.
That's that awesome record.
Very, very powerful band. That's a band that's had that huge effect on me. And there's, you know, there's more on this, like I put totally different kind of band. I put Steel Pole Bath Tub on this, Pseudoephedrine Hydrochloride, who were a super weird, I guess, noise rock band.
Yeah.
Moved around a lot. They ended up in the Bay Area. But that's that song's off the Miracle of Sound and Motion, which is not my favorite Steel Pole Bath Tub album at all, but it's my favorite Steel Pole Bath Tub song. And they were hugely influential. Like there's all these weird, like it sounds like they're just putting a tape recorder up to a TV and just recording it, and then they're like playing it on a reel to reel and spinning it backwards and making it go fast and slow. And it's just this weird shit. When you listen to it, the music is like fucking crazy. Like those guys could play. Those guys could fucking play. And just super interesting people, all three of them in that band, and they're all still quite active. And I was listening to a, what's it called, Protonic Reversal podcast, like last week, and there was an interview with Mike Moraski, the guitarist from Steel Pole Bath Tub, and it's fascinating. And if you're a fan, you should totally listen to that episode, because Mike is a really interesting person and a really talented musician. I think he composes music for video games now and movies, which is
lucky him. That's sick as well.
Incredible. But yeah, so there's a couple of bands on this that are just like absolute, oh my god, this really changed my life, and I still feel that way about it.
Moment in time.
Yeah, Steel Pole Bath Tub and Ringworm are definitely two of those bands. Was like, fuck, this really just opened up the possibilities to me of what music can do and how you can approach music.
I think I only have one other artist I included on the playlist that really was like a band that kind of opened my mind, you know, a bit, and like was like formative and shaping, because a lot of the other stuff's like newer stuff that I mm-hmm. wanted to hype. But were you ever a fan of any of the Montreal bands, like Godspeed Black Emperor, Silver Mount Zion?
It doesn't seem
like your speed, really.
I will tactfully answer that music isn't made for me.
Yeah, which is totally fair. I kind of assumed that much, to be honest.
I'm not talking. It's not made for me. It's just not made for me.
There's just always been something about it for me. I don't know. It like gets the crybaby in me. I love the grand scope and the kind of almost like the Godspeed records particularly always had this, like the physical layouts were sometimes kind of like Lynchian almost, where it was clear they were into you know, it's just, I don't know. They were on their own tip, and they almost like, it felt like they created their own universe, and all the records were really warm sounding and kind of meditative. And I guess I always had a soft spot for like orchestral stuff and ambient, mm-hmm. and like they kind of like crossed between post rock and then like those things as well. And Silver Mount Zion was like a little more abstract to me in that way.
That was some of the same people, right? Silver Mount Zion.
Yeah, definitely. And I don't know that, like the song I included is just like this really sad little anarchist ballad or whatever. Not that mm-hmm. I could ascribe to, you know, their political beliefs necessarily, but it always stuck with me.
Cards on the table. I could, if it's an anarchist ballad.
Yeah. Oh, dude, those guys are definitely, you know, all their music. Oh, actually, thematically, it's probably very aligned with intensive care, to be honest, I think, in a lot of ways.
No, politically, they are too, and I have a lot of respect. They own a couple of venues in Montreal, and I've played.
Yeah, we always play the one venue.
And it's fantastic. I love how they put their politics in motion. The content of the music,
it's so inspiring.
I respect it. It doesn't inspire me, though.
Yeah, of course.
But I kind of want to move on to another one that's on your playlist, which I think might be related to that, is the Ben Salisbury, Jeff Barrow one, which is from the movie Annihilation, the Alien. Like, tell me about that, because you know, Silver Mount Zion and Godspeed, what would be, I think, lazily referred to as cinematic. And I think what people mean is that, you know, it tells a story.
It feels like a score. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, or dude, it feels like a score. And this is an actual score. So, like, tell me about your interest in this and why this particular score. I also have something from a soundtrack on my playlist, actually. But, yeah, go. Tell me about this song.
So this movie, Annihilation, I think it kind of went under the radar. And in the books... I think it's called like the Reach trilogy. I can't remember. I own them. I read them after I watched Annihilation because I was just so floored by this movie. And it's just like this really colorful sci-fi, like, you know, body horror kind of movie. And but the score, you know, it's pretty good the whole way through. But this particular piece, I just remember being like really stoked about because the scene is so insane where the protagonist comes face to face with this alien entity that basically assumes the form it replicates, like whatever it, you know, comes into contact with. So it's a pretty trippy scene anyway. It's a little disorienting because there's like a body double kind of mocking every movement she's making.
Yeah, I remember that scene. Yeah,
you've seen it. Cool. So yeah, you know what I'm talking about. And yeah, dude, the way this little piece like swells with like the weird like it's like terrifying to me, and I feel like he just nailed the scene like shot for shot with this music, and the sounds feel so alien, like the synth just, I don't know, I don't have a really eloquent way of analyzing the track other than that it just, you know, gives me those feels. It's like extremely atmospheric and really foreboding and brooding and scary. I think, I don't know, it's just sick.
Yeah, so in a similar to the reaction you're talking about, I put on a track by Herman Kopp called Unholy. Actually, now that I say that, I wonder if that is in one of the films he scored. Herman Kopp is a German, I think he plays violin, but he also does like weird stuff with synthesizers. His violins all sound weirdly decaying and out of tune, and he did lots of music for German movies. He did part of the soundtrack for Necromantic. He did The Todesking. I think this song might be in The Todesking, actually.
those two films, dude, fuck those movies.
That's the kind of shit I like. That's my jam, right?
I'll watch those with my friends and stuff, but it's definitely not like
Watch those with your friends? Like, those are not watch with your friends movies.
No, because my friends are into horror, and I don't really give a shit about like the really over the top nasty horror like those movies.
Yeah, I know those movies. those are like existentially fucking grim as well, like vile movies. I love them. That's the kind of movie I like.
I think I'm soft because like I enjoy those. Like I said, I watch them in a social environment because the only reason I have to watch them is because for some stupid reason I have a bunch of friends that love those two movies, especially The Todesking. Like I think that's movie, Sam's shit for sure.
It's definitely my shit, and I love Herman Kopp, and I love. He did part of the soundtrack to Necromantic, but yeah, I love his stuff, and I have a number of his albums. He is someone I would love to collaborate with one day, but I know it'll never happen, and it'll certainly never happen if I never approach him to do it, which I continue not doing. But I love Herman Kopp. I love his vibe. He strikes me as someone who just doesn't give a shit and just does his own thing. I think if I asked him to work on music, he'd be like, "Who the fuck are you? Why would I do that?" But yeah, I love Herman Kopp, and his shit is deeply upsetting.
This track's really unsettling.
Yeah, it's that one's a good one. I almost put on what song did I almost put on from this album? Man Drowning Himself in a Bathtub. That one's from I think that one's from The Todesking. And that one's pretty dismal. And then there's the song Poison. I nearly put the song Poison on as well, which is also just fucking grim. But I went with Unholy.
My buddies have a film podcast called Another Look that they covered those movies in an episode. And I know like three of them, actually all four of them, even the guy who picked them, were just like, why the fuck did we pick these? Like, they were just like, I love a good reaction.
I love those movies, and I own them all on Blu-ray, but I'm not fucking sitting down to watch those. I'm not saying to my partner, hey, Chelsea, let's watch Necromancer.
Yeah, seriously.
She's gonna be like, what the fuck is this? Like, get the fuck away from me.
Well, Yeah, definitely. And like, you know, one of my friends, you know, his wife's just like a super sweet lady that's definitely not into horror, let alone like fringe shit like that. Mm-hmm. And I know he's putting her through that shit regularly. Oh, yeah, so, you know, bless her for being like so patient with that bullshit. Uh-huh. Dude, you put Shy Girl on here. So
I did put Shy Girl. I love Shy Girl.
You showed me Shy Girl. And I actually, through Shy Girl, got into a track I put on here called From Cuckoo Chloe. Who you like as much because of the auto-tuned vocals constantly. Uh-huh. But I love it.
I can't hang with auto-tune at all. I can't hang with auto-tune.
I love pretty much all the Nux stuff, actually. That's that London label that puts out all these people. And I even put another Nux track on here from this dude, Zebra Cats.
Yeah.
And actually, I like his record a lot. I wouldn't say it's like... See, I think for a while, like, I couldn't
get into...
Is that
the one with, like, the really raw sort of drum and bass sounding beats on it? Is that that one?
It has... The track I put on here has, like, a whole breakbeat section.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, yeah.
So, like, I think when I first heard trap music back in the day, I didn't like it because it wasn't lyrically dense, but I didn't really understand that was, like, it's a totally different style in itself. And I'm not saying this is trap, but I think it, like... It's in the rap world, but I don't think Zebra Cats is about like dense verses. It's like party music for Berghain, you know.
Yeah,
it's like really obnoxious, awesome beats, and some of it's a bit noisy even. And then there's like breakbeat shit, and he just sings about fucking the whole time. It's like just smut record. And like I don't think when I was younger I was comfortable like with myself to where I felt like, yeah, I'm gonna get down on some stupid music. But I like. Definitely have a huge spot for stupid music nowadays as an adult, and Zebra Cats is fucking fun. It's awesome. The record rules.
Tell me about King Krul, because you've talked to me about him before. I'm not familiar with King Krul's stuff at all.
King Krul is this kid from England. He's London, and his name's Archie. I think he's probably like in his 20s. He's really young, but so like I didn't really know much about King Krul. I saw like collabs, you know, where he was doing stuff with Trash Talk or something, that hardcore band, and I would always see like the indie emo kids in like the college scene towns that we would go through, maybe one of them would be rocking a King Krul shirt, so I didn't really think too much of him, and I don't even know what made me check it out, to be honest, finally, but I did. And it's not what I thought it was at all. It's almost like you can tell he's like really, really into jazz and very clearly into good 90s hip hop, like just through some of his production techniques. And again, like the real thing that clicks for me is his voice. Like he just has such a unique voice. Like I really feel like he's got a mastery over like what his voice can do. And he's got like a really deep timber to his voice. And it kind of like, I don't know how to explain it. He's really expressive with it. And it just sounds so fucking sick, and it's so smooth. I don't know. It's great, and his sound changes over the years too. I mean, he kind of flits between a lot of different sounds, and I don't know. I think he's a genius, and it's definitely not something I think I would have found willingly. You know, I wouldn't have gone looking for something like that a few years ago. But yeah, I pretty much had the King Krul LPs on loop for like the past 6 months in particular. I'm like a very new fan to his.
Yeah.
Just catching up, you know. It's all over the place though. There's like moments where he sounds, I feel like you can tell he loves the Stooges, you know, and then another moment it's like he's doing this like swinging like jazz. It's just so good, man. It's so chill. Yeah. And I mean, he's got such a hard accent. I don't know what part of London he's from. That to me, I also like that. I don't know. Like just adds to the music.
Yeah. Let's do a meat and potatoes one. You put Napalm Death on here, and I put Godflesh on here.
Yeah.
Let's get into the final stage of this talking about this playlist.
When did you first see these bands?
As an English lad. Yeah. I live in Canada, but I grew up in England, and that's Scotland, and my accent is a fucking goddamn mess now after 17 years of living in Canada. Napalm Death, I didn't see Napalm Death until I was in my 30s and living here, and I saw them when Endless Blockade played Maryland Death Fest in 2009. That's when I saw Napalm Death the first time. But the reason is because the various scenes got so stratified that Napalm Death was never playing a show that I would have gone to see. And I think there was a, there was like a 10 years where Napalm Death was playing music I didn't really care about.
What kind of shows were they playing that they weren't shows that you would have gone to? Like, who were they playing with? Were they like playing with a lot of death metal bands or something?
Yeah, but it wasn't even death. I couldn't even tell you, but it wasn't even death metal bands I would care about. It's like package tours. I don't like package tours.
They're exhausting, right?
Like a package tour when it's like one band who's headlining, one band who's cool that they got on the tour because they're a cool band, and then
three openers.
And then three openers that have paid to, the labels paid to get on. Like, I don't care about those.
I mean, I don't fuck with that shit at all. That pay to play shit. It just doesn't work. It's stupid. No. It's insane. And you know that shit happens in Europe, like, regularly?
Well,
and the money
here
that bands
have
will
not
play.
Have you not played those tours where you guys are the cool unknowns playing the tour? Like,
I mean, we've done package tours where we're opening for a big band and they pay us like $100 or $200 a night. And that's, we willingly do those tours, but we're not paying to do those fucking tours.
No, I know. But it's those kind of tours, all right?
Exhausting.
With the Over the Hill band, I'm not talking about Napalm Death now, but these are the kind of tours that they do. I think Napalm Death has done some good records in the last 10 years.
Dude,
some genuinely good records. More than the last 10 years. They've done some good records. Again, they had a slump. For me, it was a slump. Like, whatever.
And I just saw them over the summer again, and I was so charged up and inspired by watching them that it got me through the rest of the tour where I was just, like, on fire. Like, I was just, like, I mean, he's so poignant with his message. They were so fucking on point.
I like that they seem stoked on doing grind. Like, they still seem stoked. They're into it, which I think is great. And seeing them at MDF was like, wow, this is fucking awesome. I love this.
You know what I'm struck by every time I see Napalm Death, though? And this is stupid, but like, for me, like, Napalm Death's career is like so, like, kind of like flitting between these scenes, and they seem like a big metal band, right? At this point. Mm-hmm. But when I see them, even though they're playing to 800 people, there's no barrier or anything. And they are a fucking punk band, man. The very first time I saw Napalm Death was in Europe when I was like 20. And they played on the super low stage, and kids were just fucking stage diving the whole time. And dude, they were just going for it, man.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know, man. They're a punk band. It's just really sick when you see them, because you can't doubt it.
I have a lot of time for Napalm Death. What's your favorite Napalm Death release?
It's the one I put on here. This Peel Session shit sounds so fucking crazy. I mean, Nicaris's drumming is like,
Mine's Mentally Murdered. I think Mentally Murdered for me is the blueprint for the best grindcore. Excruciating Terror sounds like Mentally Murdered to me. Insect Warfare sounds like Mentally Murdered to me. I think for me, it's the fucking perfect distillation of the grindcore formula, Mentally Murdered. Going back to Godflesh, I saw Godflesh in, I want to say 1991, maybe it was 90, I don't know. It was around the time when Pure came out. I think it might have been just before. They were playing songs from that and songs from Street Cleaner. They were a three-piece. I'm pretty sure it was Robert Hampson, who is a musical hero of mine, was playing second guitar. He played in Main and Loop. It does a lot of, like, kind of weird experimental guitar music, but it's huge. I'm a huge, huge fan of Robert Hampson, but I'm pretty sure it was him playing second guitar in Godflesh. But yeah, I saw him in 91. It was just like real, real eye opener. They came on to like 15 minutes of just like this really fucking harsh, bass heavy, droning sounds. It really opened my mind to what audio could be. I got kicked in the face by some crusty when she stage dived. I was just like a weird 17-year-old going to see the show, and I was like, fuck, this is insane. I think they were the second heavy band I ever saw, like real. I saw a lot of different bands, but they were the second, I think, heavy band I ever saw. The first one I ever saw was Extreme Noise Terror.
What an extreme one, too.
Yeah, but those bands were huge, though, when I was a kid. Though, like, Extreme Noise Terror was on fucking BBC TV. That was the culture at the time, the late 80s, early 90s. That was the cultural moment, like Napalm Death and Extreme Noise Terror and stuff. But Godflesh, I chose what song did I put on? Was it Suction? Is that the one I put on here? Where is this playlist? Suction, yeah. It's on the reissue of Street Cleaner. I can't remember what it was originally on, though. But it's like, it's a weirder song. It's like, Godflesh always straddled a couple of different scenes. You know, they could have played shows with like early My Bloody Valentine. As an aside, the two loudest bands I've ever seen in my life were...
Yeah, I've heard that about My Bloody Valentine.
Godflesh in 91 and My Bloody Valentine in 1990. Those are the two loudest
shows I've ever been to. That's saying something that, like, almost 30 years later, like, that's still the loudest thing you've seen. Because I feel like the capability of musicians to get gear nowadays, I feel like you should have seen something louder by then. By now, I mean. But that's, like, saying something, how fucking loud it must have been.
Yeah. I mean, people who are, like, 10 years older than me will always tell me about the time when they saw Swans at the Leeds Warehouse in 1982. And they'll be like, that was the loudest thing they ever saw. You know, so I think it's just my generation.
I didn't see any of these guys being loud. The only Swans shows I've seen, obviously, Latter-day Swans, which
Swans is kind of like dad rock drone, though, now. Like, like early 80s Swans, like, all the apparently, shit. Like, obscenely loud.
Yeah, and sweaty. I've heard all kinds of funny stories about, like, shit he would pull to make it oppressive for the audience. I think it's really interesting. It's just like, I guess there was a lot of shit like that going on at the time, but it's still, I still wonder, like, what it must have been for an audience, like, you know, 30, 40 years ago to encounter, like, this really extreme form of music. Like, if it was really, like, because nowadays, like, everybody's seen it all. Like, you can just Google it and like, see, like, you know, you can see a dude driving a bulldozer through a venue, you know?
Yeah.
But, like, I don't know.
Yeah, for me, being 17 years old and going to see Extreme Noise Terror was just like, oh, my God. And again, I've talked about this on other podcasts. I talked about this on the Take a Wide podcast that I referenced in part one of this. But, like, when I was 17, punks in England were fucked up. They were, like, they were fucked up. And I remember the punks of that Extreme Noise Terror gig were, like, they were fucking scary. Like, they were fucking scary. It's not, they weren't a bunch of, like, nerds dressing up in Disclosed t-shirts like you get now at shows. Disrespect, but it's just kind of funny to me. It was really eye-opening walking in and just being like, what the fuck is this? And
it's animals.
It was like you'd walked into the set of, like, Mad Max or something. Just like it was this completely alien world to you that you had no idea existed or no window and until you were suddenly in this world, and it's like, wow, this is fucking weird. This is a whole new world and something I've never experienced before. And that was the that's kind of why I stick around in making this kind of, like, weird, shitty, obscure music, is not the hip hop stuff I do, is because it was such an effort to get into it, and it was such you lived it, you know, booking tours in Europe and playing in squats and everything.
There's something comforting about it now. Like, yeah, it's so comforting.
And it was difficult to do, and you had to struggle. And for me, it's like, I can't, you know, I'm not willing to give up on it. I'm not willing to talk shit on modern bands, like, oh, you know, you've got it so easy these days. Like, I don't do that. I don't care about that. That's a boring conversation to me. I'm still excited about music, and I'm excited that the boundaries are blurred and people can do fucking anything and it's not weird anymore. But that was hugely important, eye-opening time for me, going to see Extreme Noise Terror when I was a teenager.
Yeah, that was kind of my point. I feel like, pre-internet culture was probably, I mean, it wasn't like it wasn't there. Like, it was raging. It was, you know, all the foundations were being laid for this kind of music, but it was just so insular and it wasn't just an easy Google. There was no, like, stupid Metallum, you know, to, like,
about bands. You had to find out where something was and you had to just go.
So I just feel like the discovery of something so extreme to me would have been, like, really eye-popping. And I had a mini version of that experience, I guess. The first grindcore band I saw, who I'm sure you never heard of, was this, you know, early 2000s grindcore band from Pennsylvania called Robinson, who was really fucking fast and, like, really crazy, awesome vocals. Like, I really, really loved them at the time, but I'd never heard proper grindcore before. Mm-hmm. And I went out to this show in this little Amish town. It was at this elementary school gym, and this band Robinson set up, and they were, like, they looked fucking completely wasted. And, you know, to me, I was like 13, 14 years old, dude, my fucking jaw hit the floor. It was all I ever, like, from the first minute that band started playing, I was just like, I gotta play, like, the fastest, most extreme I can, you know, whatever that might've meant for me at the time.
So that, I was that, that would, That was the band for you going to see that band Robinson when you were a kid?
I mean, they were just like the first proper what I would call grindcore band that like really blew my wig off. The first band that really put me on the path was my other friend Jordan that got me into all this Griselda stuff and you know countless other bands and helped me with my vocal performance and everything. He had a band that was, you know, him and his friends when we were probably, he was probably like 13, 14. I was like 12 or 13. And it was my very first show and it was in a house. And his band sounded like, they loved Cryptopsy. They were like obsessed with Cryptopsy and Dying Fetus. And to me, it was like, it had grindy parts, you know, and it also had like really crazy, like rhythmic slammy shit with the bass fills and like really crazy like vocal delivery because he loved Fetus and because he loved, you know, Lord Worm singing. And then he was also really into rap. Mm-hmm. So when I saw them, I didn't even know a kid could scream. And I was just like, you know what I mean? It was just like, fuck everything I'm listening to. I need to listen to all of that. And that is my world. And it never really changed, but it's so cool to like, think of those moments for, you know, whatever kid or for us, like what they might have been. I don't know. I love those stories. I think it's sick.
We haven't talked about everything on this playlist. I kind of feel like we shouldn't talk about everything on this playlist because then this will be like 3 hours long. Is there anything that you want to talk about still on your list or on my list that we haven't mentioned yet?
The last thing I want to say is, have you heard that? I see there's a Kickback song on here. Have you heard that story about him going to the kitchen of the venue to boil water, to throw boiling water on a bunch of people?
I've heard many stories about that man, and I feel like most of them are true. He's an absolute fucking lunatic of a man.
Yeah, we're not going to even tell the stories. But the boiling water story always struck me as, you know, just like a good campfire story.
Well, yeah, and I have, and I've got Apartment 213 on this playlist as well, and Steve from so. You know, when you go see a band, and I'm sure the gentle listener at home can relate to this. You go see a band and it's got like an angry singer and they make all the right faces because, you know, someone might take a picture and put it on Instagram. So they make all the right scary faces and they walk around and they stare at people and when they're not singing and they just stare everyone out. And then occasionally they might just like push their friend a bit.
And I can think of a bunch of examples.
We can all think it. There's probably I was gonna say there's probably 15 of those bands playing right now in the city, but they're not. No one's playing in the city because we're in fucking lockdown because it's COVID-19. But we've all seen those bands 8 million times. And Steve from Apartment 213 was not that dude. So I'm not saying this is a wow, cool, crazy, like fucking whatever. Like I consider Steve a friend of mine, known him a long time. Steve was not that person who would like stare you out. Steve was, and then push his friend. Steve was a person who would bring like fucking circular sword discs and throw them not over people's heads but at people. He would cinder blocks or they were just like fucked up, dude.
Yeah, I don't got time for that shit anymore.
No, me neither. Me neither. And me when I've seen that kind of stuff in the past, and I kind of like it, but I like that because this is why. And this speaks to a lot of the person I used to be, and I'm not this person anymore. But when a band is starting to be violent, I'm like, yes. But I'm not like, okay, the band should only be violent to the audience. I like to get violent back to the band. So if the band throws stuff at the audience, I like to throw stuff at the band.
Right.
Like if the singer likes to, you know, push people around, I used to like put the singer in a fucking
Shogun
headlock.
Style.
I'd put the singer. I did this a few times, but like when I was a much younger and stupider person, would, you know, put a singer in a headlock and just fucking run around the venue with them while they're trying to scream. Because I'm like, oh, you're trying to be crazy? You know, I'm okay with that violent mentality of bands.
I understand where you're coming from.
But also I'm like, but you got to expect the audience to be fucking violent back to you. And I kind of was that person once upon a time. Steve, my story about Steve from Apartment 213 is Endless Blockade played in Cleveland, and Steve and Jim Fallaheen did like a part of the noise set at the end with us at the end, and Steve set the fucking venue on fire whilst we were playing. I'm like, oh, cool. And the thing about All Steve, right. I fucking love Steve, but he really changed his life around dramatically. Here's the thing: a lot of people don't know about Steve. Steve was always a Christian. And considered himself as Christian, even when he was like being a lunatic and trying to kill the audience.
He's a suffering Christian.
But he's really changed his life around now. Like, he won't curse anymore. He's very devoted to his faith.
I mean, good for him. That's fucking awesome.
He had a lot of medical issues, and a part of his overcoming his medical issues was through his faith. And I find it kind of interesting that Steve is, you know, if you see him on Instagram now, he does a single scogging, which is like cross between jogging and skateboarding, and he's like he's a real enthusiast of that, and it's like
he's living his life.
I love that about him, but I also know him as the fucking lunatic that would bring dynamite to shows, like actual dynamite.
And the thing about that is, I have some friends that I would consider to be kind of like maybe not as extreme as that, but like they get a bad reputation for being aggressive at shows or whatever, but they play in these bands that kind of push out this dangerous image, and they're like, those bands are a dime a dozen when they're like, we're bad, we're fucking evil, blah, blah, blah. But it's like. Mm-hmm. Are you really surprised when like a band comes around that says they're about all this crazy shit and then they're actually about it? Like, isn't that kind of like, I'm not an asshole and I don't endorse these kind of activities, but like, are you really shocked when like they're about what they say they're about? The shit they're singing about over and over about fucking people up and like burning the whole world down around them, and then because they actually are that, and you're so surprised. Like, that audience surprise, I don't get. I really don't.
I've been around a long time and I've seen a lot of fucked up stuff in my life, and honestly the fucked up stuff I've seen in my life has never been at a fucking punk show or a metal show. Like, ooh, you brought a pig's head on stage and you fucking threw it around, like what fucking ever. I'm not saying I
do think that, like, you know, at least the shows that I attend and that I play, I do want them to be like safe places for everybody. I just feel like if this band starts and they're just like, we're fucking Gigi Allen, we're gonna beat people, it's like, don't be surprised when you attend their show and then they're fucking crazy and they hit you.
I guess the point I'm making is, even when that does happen, you can see way worse if you just open your eyes a bit in the world, because like, even the crazy stuff that happens at punk and metal shows, usually, other than, you know, some examples here and there, but usually it ain't that crazy, really. It's just someone throwing a someone throwing a pig's head around or kicking a fucking fire escape in or, you know, setting off fireworks in a pit. Like, it's not
right. Yeah, yeah.
Sometimes that's annoying, and you can get injured with that stuff. You can, you know, when someone's throwing a fucking cinder block in the crowd, you can get fucking injured. But
I mean, and I'm not fucking interested in getting hurt at a show, to be honest. And
no, me neither.
When I was young, I looked at a lot of crazy vocalists, like, not so much like guys that would hurt people, but just guys that would kind of like fuck themselves up and like, you know, rolling around and like jumping on people. And I thought that was the best thing in the world. And I still love watching it. But as like I got older and started playing in Full of Hell, I realized I don't want to be fucking touched when I'm watching a band. I shouldn't be fucking touching anybody. And like, you know, when I was a kid, I would like hit people and like all kinds of crazy shit when I was in high school, but like, not about that at all. Like, just for me personally, that's just my experience now. It's like, don't fucking touch people. I'm not about it. I don't want to ruin anybody's time.
Well, for me, it's like, if you're a singer in the band doing that, like fucking touching people, it's like, yeah, do that. But a person like me will fucking slap you.
And then, and be prepared for that.
And smile in your face after doing it.
Like, exactly.
Like, what? I mean, I'm an old man now. I'm not going to do that now. And I just want a fucking easy, quiet life. So I'm not interested.
Same here. I'm really not.
There's been points in my life where that's how it was. If that's what a band was doing. But now, no.
Here's what I want to end on. So, I think it's interesting that Column of Heaven had like confrontational vibes singer wise. I remember maybe this was Abyss, and if it is, I'm sorry, but Dave jumped into the front of the audience apparently and bit some lady's burrito.
Abyss. That was Abyss, and it was Seb who plays guitar in that band Gasm.
That's the kind of confrontation I can get down with. When I read that, guy took a bite out of my burrito, I fucking cried.
I think Seb, who was the burrito owner at the time, would probably laugh about that now and doesn't really give a shit anymore. Yeah, I don't know. I mean
that's a cartoon.
Column of Heaven had some confrontational vibes and whatever. I don't think it was really much of anything. No. Endless Blockade definitely did, and going back to what you were saying, you don't want to be touched when you're playing, so like, don't fucking touch me. Like, yeah, I get that. But for me, I remember the last Endless Blockade tour when we, which was with Hatred Surge in Southern US, and it was when Bloomer, who's in intensive care, was in the band, and it got kind of annoying for me because Matthew, our singer, was going through a lot of stuff in his life, and was often working it out on the audience in a very physical kind of way. Yeah. And again, was not that person who went up and lightly pushed his friend, would just like fucking just go nuts. And Matthew's not like, he doesn't look like a dude who would play in Hatebreed or Haymaker. He's a little guy. He's just like,
you're right.
And for me, it kind of got boring on that tour because we would be playing and then I would notice half the audience would get pissed and they wanted to fight Matthew. And
this repetitious activity every night.
I don't want the show to end with Matthew getting his ass fucking handed to him. So then it would end up being me and Bloomer playing, but also trying to fucking crowd manage at the same time so Matthew didn't get badly injured. Like if he pushes someone and someone fucking pushes him back, I don't give a shit. Like,
yeah.
You're asking for that. But I don't want three guys to
need getting his teeth knocked out. I don't want
three guys to jump him.
And it takes almost nothing sometimes to trigger that member of the audience from just like cracking you.
Crowds get weird.
I mean, you just don't know who the person is on the other side of that. I was moshing one time like a little kid, and some dude poured a whole beer on my head and tried to break the glass over my head.
And I just remember thinking probably because you moshed into him and you didn't even realize you did, and that guy got really pissed. I know.
Yeah, exactly.
I've been that dude too. Yeah, fucking whatever. It's not that big of a deal, but yeah,
no.
I definitely those antagonistic shenanigans. I got bored of them because the shows would not stop being fun for me to play because I am playing security for my own band at the same time.
I guess maybe I'm not even necessarily dismissive of it as in general as a practice, but I realized that I'm not the antagonist. You know what I mean? I never was that guy. I don't want to headwalk on a bunch of people. I was never the guy that even accidentally wants to hurt anybody. And that's all right. I thought maybe I had to be this like, you know, drooling psycho. It's just not who I am. And you can always tell when they're putting it on.
Oh yeah.
I mean, like, there's whole waves of these bands where just like, we're crazy and we're going to swing chains and blah, 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 blah. And it's just, I don't know.
And those were always the bands I would go, oh, you're crazy? Because guess what? I fucking hate the world too.
I'll throw
a chair back at you. Oh, we're doing this? Cool. I'm going to throw a chair at you because apparently that's what we're doing now in this room.
I'm sure you find out half the time that it's theatrics. And then they're just, oh shit, this guy's getting aggro.
There was a band that came through at Glasgow and were doing that. And me and Jamie from Shank and a couple other friends, they were like, you know, trying to be aggro. And there was a bunch of chairs stacked at the side of the venue. And we just then spent the next 10 minutes throwing chairs at the band.
And they got really
irritated. It's like, oh, but dude, you came to Glasgow where everything fucking sucks and is violent. And you start throwing things around. So we're like, oh, cool, this is the funny game we're playing in the room now. Like, don't fucking do that if you don't want that to happen. Because people like us will do that with the time.
People love to talk the talk. But maybe they're not ready for the reality.
No.
Nobody's ready. Let's be real.
And just to make a point, there's nothing even remotely threatening or scary or tough about me at all.
That's perspective.
Yeah.
I'm sure you're threatening to doom when food goes uneaten or when human food gets eaten.
Doom is the name of my dog for anyone who's like, what are you talking about? Yeah, Doom.
Yeah, I didn't mean to bring Doom into this, but it's almost impossible.
Doom, named after Lorna Doom, bass player from The Germs, before anyone thinks it's the video game or MF Doom.
Yeah, I figured it was just after the video game.
No, Lorna Doom from The Germs.
One Way Straight. Holy Mountain Printing Podcast.
Listen to this!